Al Jazeera Podcasts.
30 years of freedom. South Africans are marking three decades since the end of apartheid. But the country is facing major challenges as it heads into an election. So has the governing ANC failed to live up to its promises? I'm Neve Barker and you're listening to the Inside Story podcast, where we dissect, analyse and help define major global stories. OK, so let's bring in all of our guests. All three of them are joining us from Cape Town. Melanie Furwood is a political analyst and a former member of South Africa's parliament under President Nelson Mandela. William Gumede is founder and executive chairperson of the Democracy Works Foundation. And Zaki Akhmat, who is an activist and an independent candidate for South Africa's parliament. A very warm welcome to all three of you. Zaki, I wonder if I can start with you. We've heard some of the examples there of the failings of the ANC in recent years, the failure to create jobs, address poverty, issues to do with utilities, energy supplies. All of these are cited as reasons to punish the ANC at the polls. Give us a sense of the lived experience of what it's like for South Africans to face these challenges.
Hello, Neve and everyone. My experience has been half of my life lived under apartheid and the other half lived in democracy. And as you would know, I'm a former ANC member. I joined when I was in prison in 1980. My understanding is that April 1994 was a moment which gave dignity back to black people in many different ways. Of course, we've not realized that a right to dignity for everyone. But what we had under apartheid, the critical dispossession of black African people, the land dispossession and intellectual dispossession, where people were prepared only to become cheap labor, bodies for cheap labor, as opposed to human beings fully rounded, educated to be dignified citizens of a country. So in looking forward, in looking at that time, virtually every part of one's life was calculated to enforce apartheid, to enforce the system of apartheid. When you went to school, when you went to work, when you went to the post office, how you use public transport. Every aspect of life was controlled by rules that reinforce the idea of white supremacy. And so what happened in 1999, or what happened between 1994 and 1999 was, in a sense, our Prague Spring, because every part of the ANC was dedicated to making life better for everyone. When you look at what the ANC achieved in the five to 10 years...
Zaki, let me jump in and what I want to clarify is whether recent failings have in some way eclipsed past achievements. William, let me put that to you, because also cited is disappointment with the AC that it's lost its, quote, moral compass. What do people mean when they say the ANC has lost its moral compass, William?
No, thank you. And thank you for having me on the program. I think it's a mixed legacy. The ANC has left a mixed legacy. On the one hand, I mean, we've got the political freedom. We can move around. And I'm also a child who grew up and had my youth during the apartheid era. So mixed legacy. We've taken away formal apartheid laws. We've created a constitution, new laws, and so on, and freedom. But it almost stops there. I mean, in reality, the democracy has benefited small elites. A small elite, if you connected to the ANC in one way or the other, you would have benefited. If you're white, big corporate, big business, you would have benefited. But a large majority of South Africans materially has almost remained where they were during the apartheid era.
Melanie, do you agree with that? A small elite, the cream of the crop, those are the people that have benefited from the work of the ANC in recent years. As someone who was elected as a member of parliament for the ANC under Nelson Mandela, what is it like to hear this criticism of what the party looks like today?
Look, I think many, like the other two guests, William and Zaki, I also grew half of my life under apartheid, and I was privileged enough to be part of the parliament under Nelson Mandela and then the beginning of Thabo Mbeki as well. The thing about it is, I mean, many of us, I think all of us, I think everybody on this show would also tell you that we are deeply, deeply disappointed in what has happened and you know, disillusioned in some respects. I mean, I do agree that a small elite has benefited greatly. That's true of, as William said, also of the whites. They have still benefited from post-apartheid. It's also from people in business. It's also a growing black middle class. I think one needs to also acknowledge that, you know, that it is still, as bad as things are for the majority of poor people in this country, it is in some ways still better than it was, not only because they have democratic rights and freedoms, but also because things in some respects have improved. Things like free education, free university education if you are poor, water, access to water, even though in some places that's become a problem now. If when there is electricity, the majority of people in this country has electricity, etc. So I think there's a narrative that's developed in the country and that has spilled in overseas as well, that nothing good has happened in the last 30 years. And I don't believe that is true, even though we face enormous challenges and things have gone wrong, and particularly under the Zuma regime.
I'm curious to turn back the clock and talk about the journey South Africa has been on since the end of apartheid and the legacy, of course, of colonialism that still very much haunts the present. William, did negotiations back in 1994, the settlements that brought an end to apartheid, give away perhaps too many concessions to white South Africans?
No, I don't think so. You know, incidentally, I thought so, possibly in the beginning, but I mean, looking back, that was not the case. You know, we've had a negotiated transition where none of the different players were strong enough to take control. I mean, we could not have a revolution. A compromise agreement, I think, was good for South Africa. And it, you know, put the framework, the democratic framework, the rules for us to transform as a society. So I think, sadly, a lot of young black youth are now blaming the 1994 negotiations as giving away too much to white South Africans. I think, the hand it was, the ANC was dealt with at the time, they worked with it to the best what they could do at the time. And we've got the framework to transform the society. And I think the failure of the ANC government has nothing to do with the negotiations and with a compromise, but it's a self-inflicted failure. I mean, it's a corruption, an incompetence has nothing to do with the negotiation compromises.
Let me still, though, dig into this narrative in a little bit more detail, if I may, because it is the perception, as you mentioned there, of some young South Africans. I mean, just to clarify, white South Africans were allowed to keep, arguably, the spoils of racist white supremacy, namely land and assets. And it doesn't take, of course, an economist to realise that wealth begets wealth and that a lack of opportunities leads to stagnation. I wonder, Zaki, whether that is why you are now standing as an independent.
Let me start at a different spot and say this to you. Between 94 and 99, we had a parliament that worked and that was serious about ensuring the country was good. And after that, under Mbeki and right through, our parliament essentially became a choir for corruption. And the state capture years is something that the devastation wrought by the ANC on every aspect of delivery, of honesty, of ensuring that we have an open, accountable public administration, all that has failed. It is our duty now to ensure that the country goes on to a better path. But if you look at today, literally, there is the racial divisions that have existed here in the Western Cape. There is serious racial division between colored black African people and colored people. The deep racism that exists is being used to whip up emotion and so on, to divide people because no change has come fundamentally for working class people over the last few years. In fact, the cost of living, the ability to access work, all this has been taken away. If you check, if you simply look at our public transport, our rail transport, which was destroyed, it is now coming back. But literally for almost 4 or 5 years, there was hardly any commuter rail. At the same time, Transnet, which is freight rail, goods can barely move from one place to the other. So I would say that, yes, white people have benefited and continue to benefit, as does black middle class people like myself. We in a position of extreme privilege, but on the other hand, if we don't fix the state for working people, then we won't fix the state for all of us. And that's a difficult time to be in.
Melanie, do you agree with that? I mean, you have a particularly interesting personal story in that you joined the ANC, you married Wilhelm Verwoerd, the grandson of one of the architects of apartheid. You were ostracised from your community for joining the ANC. Do you think that Nelson Mandela went far enough in creating a bedrock for a long-lasting so-called rainbow nation?
You know, I think Professor Ngumedi answered it very well. The point was, of course, the ANC wanted to go further at the time, and most probably morally, and they were justified to have gone further. But it would have resulted in a civil war. We wouldn't have had peace. And the amazing thing about our story of 30 years ago is that we achieved in South Africa something which nobody thought was going to be possible, to have a peaceful transition to a democratic state with one of the most liberal constitutions in the world. And these things have persevered through the last 30 years. Our constitution is standing, even though some young people are questioning it. Our judiciary is independent, our press is independent, we have an independent prosecuting authority. You know, we have, as your clip in the beginning said, we have a president that has gone to jail, we have got a speaker who's in front of the courts, we have an ex-secretary general of the ANC in front of the courts. All these things are actually phenomenal signs of a country that has achieved, you know, on a democratic front so much. I do believe, though, as a white person, that we have, as whites, intergenerational responsibility that we carry, and that is to contribute to this country. Not many whites share that opinion with me, but I feel very strongly about that, you know, and that we have a responsibility to keep on contributing to this country and not just sit on the edges and moan and criticize.
Interesting that you mentioned the judiciary there, because one of the things often mentioned by members of the ANC is that there is an inability to implement much-needed reforms, that their hands are tied largely because of the makeup of the judiciary, a concern being that today the judiciary represent roughly, white members of the judiciary represent 30% of the bench, even though whites only make up around 7% of the population. William, what does that mean in practice?
You know, I think that is overplayed, that kind of criticism. I think, you know, our judiciary actually has been one of the really important key independent organizations that has prevented us sliding even further down. I mean, this country would have been Zimbabwe right now if it wasn't for the judiciary and the media and civil society. And of course, also that we've got a big business. I mean, we've got a competitive business sector, which has helped with state failure. Otherwise, you know, as a country, we would have been on the floor now. But again, you know, 30 years, many other societies in 30 years actually made a turnaround. And I think we have given the ANC too much of a free pass. And that really is our problem. I mean, if you think about Singapore, within 30 years, it had become a developed country. It had some of our sort of racial divisions also at the beginning. We were just not tough enough, and I include myself in there. I mean, I was a journalist in the early years of the transition. And we just, you know, because of the ANC's liberation path, we thought the ANC will be, and individual leaders will be morally upright, they will be responsible and honest. That has not been the case, and we have not punished them enough electorally.
So the former President Jacob Zuma's description, Zaki, of the judicial system there as a judicial dictatorship is an exaggeration?
Well, this is what I can say about the former, the convicted, criminally convicted former president of South Africa, Jacob Zuma, clearly has a bone to pick with the judiciary, who's trying to hold him accountable. If anything, our judiciary has become not only racially transformed, but also in terms of gender. And the difficulty is now that the new judges, particularly new black judges, don't come from a background of the ANC struggle for liberation. What they come from is a new period. And in fact, very often you have black judges that are more conservative than white judges. So the pity is that political battles are being fought in our courts. When we need to look at our public protector's corruption, it's in the courts. When we have to look at the ANC's corruption in terms of its ministers and so on, all of that falls onto the judges to make a decision. Right. Because one of the things that has happened is citizens don't participate as much as we need to.
Let's move on and talk about coalition building, because according to recent polls, just over 40% of voters say that they will back the once, of course, mighty ANC going forward. Of course, if the AMC want to stay in power, the challenging job of coalition building will be necessary. What would that mean for the country's political landscape, William?
Yes, the ANC may be on the retreat, but the ANC very likely is going to be potentially a player, but a player as a coalition in a coalition. I think I know a lot of South Africans are very worried about coalition politics because at municipal level, four of the big cities have actually failed from a coalition point of view. Although I keep on reminding people that there are 32 coalitions at a municipal level, the majority of them have been absolutely successful. I, of course, have been involved in putting together, as an independent negotiator, putting together South Africa's first pre-electoral coalition, which is called a multi-party charter. Now, we've put, and I've got involved and I accepted to do this, to prepare, I think, the country for coalitions at a national and provincial level, because that's the space where we're going to be. And I also think coalitions are much more appropriate, it's a much better or more appropriate model for diverse societies. We've seen it in Brazil. They've had since the late 1950s consistently coalition politics. We've seen it in Mauritius, we've seen it in Cape Verde. The success stories in Africa has been coalition-less. Since Melanie, the Second World War, so I think it's an appropriate model.
Right. Melanie, do you agree with that, that a coalition government would be better suited to the type of South Africa that exists today?
In theory, I do. In praxis, I'm concerned about it. It is true that the vast majority of local authorities have been successful in coalitions, but those have been the smaller ones. The big ones like Johannesburg, Nelson Mandela, the metropoles where they've had coalition governments have been big failures and they've really struggled. And we know from around the world, democracies, even all democracies, struggle with this. And my own experience from having been in politics is many of these politicians are not mature enough to actually do what is best for the country. So I am concerned about it. I think, though, it will work. I think the reason why it will work is that, as Professor Comedy mentioned, the strongest party will, without doubt, from what we can see from the opinion polls, still be the ANC. So they would be the strong anchor. And what they will then, and I think that is what is important when you transition into coalitions, is that you have one strong party that then can hold the coalitions together. And when you have lots of small parties, that can be very unstable. And I think that's the last thing our country needs at the moment.
Well, then I should probably put that to Zaki, shouldn't I? Standing as an independent, does being part of a smaller cohort of independent politicians weaken or strengthen the country? Is it more representative of the country today?
Well, the place to start is to say that people are dissatisfied with political parties, that the majority of our people don't vote and the majority of people don't trust political parties. And so the need to bring back MPs will do constituency work like people did in the days of Melani and so on is absolutely essential. Me, personally, I wouldn't join any coalition, but I would support the election of a president who stands on the basis of anti-corruption and has a clear road forward for fixing the state, because fixing the state requires nothing else can happen. No jobs can happen. No any of the promises made can't occur unless we fix the state. So I'm worried that at national level, the country is deeply unstable. In July 2021, we had an attempted coup by the criminally convicted Jacob Zuma and his people. Similarly, they're trying to stir it up now against the Independent Electoral Commission and so on. So where I stand is we need to create stability.
Okay. William, as we approach the end of the show, can I ask you this closing question? After 30 years of power, should we be surprised that the country might want change? Isn't that part of what a healthy democracy looks like?
Absolutely. You know, the country needs change. And our problem up to so far is that the ANC has been in power for too long. And people have been voting for it based on the past, not in the present. And that brings a lack of accountability. And I mean, the ANC had up to now had no real reason or no real incentive to deliver for its people, because, it can be a failure and still be returned to power. And that has been the structural weakness. So the country is ready for change.
Melanie, you're nodding your head.
Yeah, I'm not surprised that people want change. And I think it is also, if you look around the world, inevitable that this kind of thing happens to former liberation movements, that people start getting impatient and, and they have a right to be angry at the moment with what has happened in the country. I think there is, enormous hope for South Africa. And I think we need to hold on to that.
OK, well, many thanks to all three of you, Melanie Furwood, William Gumede and Zaki Akmat. It's been a pleasure to have you on the programme. This episode was produced by Gloria Wangel-Lasalle, Imogen Kimber, Michael Harwood, Jimmy Getterhun and Andre Utasusen. Studio sound was by Aston Goodison. The programme was edited by Zain Abada and Joe DeFrias. Be sure to subscribe to the Inside Story podcast to catch every episode. Thank you for listening. Tune in on Sunday for our next edition.
Coming up on The Take, former President Donald Trump takes his case to the Supreme Court. What could that mean for the upcoming presidential election? That's The Take by Al Jazeera. Find it wherever you listen to podcasts.